Welcome to Podcast Commentary, the podcast about podcasts. This is where we analyze, discuss, react, and comment on the latest, most popular, and honestly, some of the most dense podcast episodes out there.
We try to pull out the key threads so you can get right to the good stuff.
And today, we have a big one, a monumental task, really. We're diving into Chris Williamson's recent appearance on the Joe Rogan Experience.
That's episode number 2418. And it was, you know, a monster, nearly 3 hours long.
And Chris Williamson, for anyone who doesn't know, he's the host of the Modern Wisdom podcast, a big YouTuber. This was actually his second time on JRE recently.
Right. He was on hashtag 2293 as well. And that was also almost 3 hours.
So we're talking about, what, 6 hours of conversation between them in a relatively short time?
Exactly. And that tells you something. He's a guest who can really go deep on a huge range of topics. I mean, the sheer breadth of it was incredible.
Yeah, they were just jumping all over the place. One minute it's deep cognitive science. The next it's high-stakes sports. Then incredibly controversial social issues.
It's a massive amount of material to unpack.
So that's our mission here. We want to give you the clarity and the context to really understand the most insightful parts of that marathon conversation.
Yeah.
And they started with something that I think affects absolutely everyone listening.
The digital drain.
The digital drain. Yeah, specifically the addictive nature of our screens.
And the key framing they used right at the start was that this is, and this is a quote, an unfair fight.
An unfair fight. What do they mean by that?
Well, we tend to blame ourselves, right? We think, oh, I have bad willpower. I can't put my phone down.
Sure, yeah.
But the point they were making is that these apps, these feeds, they are not accidental distractions. They are meticulously designed products.
Right. They're built by the most profitable companies in human history.
Companies that employ armies of the world's smartest behavioral scientists, neuropsychologists, economists.
Their entire job, their only goal, is to figure out how to capture and hold on to your attention.
So the simple act of looking away becomes this, like, Herculean task. You're not fighting your own weakness. You're fighting a billion-dollar algorithm designed to know you better than you know yourself.
And when you start to actually look at the numbers, the data on this, it gets pretty alarming.
It's sobering. The statistics they cited were that many people, especially in the younger generations, are now spending more time on their screens than they are asleep.
Let's just sit with that for a second. More time on screens than sleeping.
And they put a hard number on it. For an average 18-year-old, the screen time is somewhere between 7 and 8 hours.
Every single day.
Every day. So, you know, you think about the opportunity cost of that. If you're aiming for 8 hours of sleep, then staring at a screen is the single biggest thing you do with your waking life.
Which leads to this really profound insight they shared. For a huge number of people, the digital world is the real world now.
It has to be. I mean, it's where they spend most of their time, where their social interactions happen. It's more real, in a way, than physical reality.
Hmm. And that completely changes what we think of as, you know, normal human behavior.
Yeah, they brought up that no phone photo project. Have you seen this?
I think so, yeah. The artist takes pictures of people, but digitally removes the phone from their hands.
Exactly. And you're left with these images of people just staring down at their empty hands in this, like, strange, almost prayer-like posture.
A posture that would have seemed completely insane 20 years ago.
Utterly bizarre, but now it's just normal. We're a society conditioned to stare at a glowing rectangle, and this is only going to get more intense.
Which brought them to the future of it all. The beta AR glasses.
Right, the one Zuckerberg's company is testing. This was a chilling part of the conversation.
Because it's not about a screen anymore. It's about merging the digital and the real. These glasses let you move a cursor with your eyeballs.
With your eyeballs.
Uh-huh.
And you interact just by, like, pinching your fingers together in the air.
It bypasses everything. The keyboard, the mouse, the phone screen.
Mm.
It's just thought and gesture.
It's a massive leap towards... Yep. You know, total human-machine integration. It's about making communication as fast as thought, which is a whole other topic they get into later.
But the cost is this complete saturation of your reality with the digital layer. So if you're listening to this, why does that 7 or 8 hours matter so much?
The conversation framed it perfectly. It's about recognizing what that time is. It's a resource.
The most valuable resource you have.
Time and attention, they're finite. And every second you spend consuming, you're not producing. That 8 hours could be a new language, a new skill, a business, deep connections with family.
Instead, it just evaporates into scrolling.
It's a huge, unappreciated loss of personal capital, a trade-off that most of us make without even thinking about it.
And then, from that very personal, individual level, the conversation made this incredibly jarring pivot.
It really did. They went from individual time management straight into global politics and activism.
Yeah, specifically the climate change divide.
Yeah.
And the way they kicked it off was with that anecdote that was all over the news.
The activists, led by Greta Thunberg, dyeing the canals in Venice green.
And the official response was almost laughably small, right? It's like a 48-hour ban and a tiny fine.
$170 fine, yeah.
Yeah.
But the key thing they focused on wasn't the act itself, but the rhetoric around it. They cited Sky News Australia calling Thunberg a Swedish doom goblin.
A Swedish doom goblin.
And that immediate, you know, ad hominem attack, attacking the person instead of the idea, that was the entry point for their whole analysis of the psychology here.
Right. They tried to unpack why activism gets so aggressive, so inflammatory. They used the movie Don't Look Up as an analogy.
That's a perfect analogy. You feel like you have this essential world-ending truth, but nobody in power is listening to you.
So you feel like you have to shout louder. You have to get more disruptive. You have to throw soup on a Van Gogh.
You believe the extremity is justified by the stakes? But the core argument from Joe Rogan and Chris Williamson was that this approach is fundamentally deeply flawed.
It's counterproductive.
Completely. The axe, the soup, gluing yourself to a highway, dying a historic canal. They fail because they inconvenience and, more importantly, they scold the general public.
Which they said is a really bad way to change minds.
The worst way. It might make you feel righteous inside your own bubble. It might rally the people who already agree with you. But for the vast majority of people in the middle,
it just creates resentment and pushes them away and hardens their opposition to your cause.
Yeah. And that skepticism about the method of the activism led them straight into a much deeper and much more controversial discussion of the scientific counterarguments.
They really started to challenge the dominant climate narratives here.
They did. They started by emphasizing the need for a much longer term perspective. They pointed to natural climate data showing that Earth's climate has never, ever been static.
Right. These huge cycles of glaciation and warming that happen over what? Thousands of years?
12,500 years or more, so the climate is always in flux. The idea that it should just stay exactly as it is right now is, historically speaking, kind of an anomaly.
And then they brought up a really provocative point. The idea that the real historical threat to life on Earth hasn't been warming, but cooling.
Correct. Their argument, based on the geologic record, is that during extreme cooling periods, CO2 and oxygen levels drop so low that we come dangerously close to losing all plant life. The saying they used was, when it gets warm, you move. When it gets cold, you die.
It's a very different way of framing the risk.
It is. And they coupled that with some pretty sharp criticism of high-profile climate media, specifically Al Gore's movie, An Inconvenient Truth.
What was the main critique there?
The predictions. They argued that the film presented these catastrophic sea level rises, like 20 feet, as something that was just around the corner, creating this sense of imminent chaos.
Whereas the actual science suggests those kinds of changes would happen over centuries, not decades.
Exactly. And they pointed out that a court in the UK had actually identified 9 specific factual errors or exaggerations in the film. So for a movement that says follow the science, having your most famous piece of media contain admitted exaggerations, it damages credibility.
And all of this led them to what they called the core problem with the whole debate, the focus on carbon instead of pollution.
This was a really important distinction they made. They said the measurable, tangible, undeniable human harm is pollution.
Right. Plastic choking rivers, garbage patches in the ocean, toxins in the groundwater, things you can see and measure and agree are bad.
Disgusting, tangible problems that require immediate action. But the entire global political focus is on carbon.
And that's where they introduced what they called the carbon paradox.
The paradox being that carbon dioxide is, you know, plant food. It's essential for life. They cited data showing that the Earth is literally greener today than it was 100 years ago.
Because of the increased CO2 in the atmosphere acting like a fertilizer?
Now, to be fair and balanced here, we have to add the caveat that the JRE discussion didn't really touch on the other side of that coin, which is ocean acidification from all that CO2 absorption.
A crucial point, for sure. But their focus was on questioning the singular demonization of carbon. And that brought them to the follow the money part of the argument.
Perverse incentives. Why, they asked, is there this relentless focus on an invisible gas when we have tangible pollution everywhere?
And the answer they proposed was money and politics.
Yeah. They cited data suggesting that in some of these massive climate-focused nonprofits, A huge percentage of the donations, up to 95% in some cases, goes to salaries, marketing, and overhead.
Not to actually cleaning anything up.
Which creates a perverse incentive. The organization's survival depends on the crisis narrative continuing, because that's what keeps the donations flowing and pays the high salaries. The problem becomes the business model.
And politically, it's the same thing. Campaigning on the climate crisis is real is a proven vote winner. It's a cycle of virtue signaling and funding.
And to put all this into context, they brought in some really stark data about energy and human survival.
Yeah, this was shocking. They said the climate-related deaths have actually gone down.
Down by 98% over the last century. A massive, massive drop.
And why?
Primarily because of cheap, reliable energy, fossil fuels. That energy allows us to build strong infrastructure, to heat our homes in the cold, to cool them in the heat. It fundamentally protects us from climate extremes.
Which leads to their really powerful conclusion that railing against fossil fuels is a luxury belief.
It's a belief you can only afford to have if you live in the wealthy West, where you have guaranteed, unlimited access to energy.
Right. They pointed out that 1 billion people on Earth still don't have reliable electricity.
500 million are still burning wood and animal dung inside their homes just to cook and stay warm. For them, reliable and cheap is infinitely more important than clean. To deny them that in the name of a political ideal is, well, it's a luxury they can't afford.
And the final piece of this was putting climate change in a hierarchy of actual existential risks.
Yeah, they referenced Toby Odell's work from Oxford's Future of Humanity Institute. When you rank all the things that could actually wipe out humanity in the next century,
where does climate change fall?
It's ranked as a 1 in 1,000 chance. Significant, but not at the top.
And what's higher?
Unaligned AI is a 1 in 10 chance, and an engineered pandemic is 1 in 30.
Wow. So the argument is that we're spending our entire worry budget on a lower tier risk,
yeah,
while largely ignoring the much bigger, more immediate threats.
Exactly. Which is the perfect segue to the next part of their discussion.
Hmm.
What happens when you do see one of those big threats coming, but no one will listen to you?
Right. This is where they got into the Cassandra complex and the whole idea of suppressing uncomfortable ideas.
The Cassandra complex from the Greek myth. The curse of being able to see the future clearly, but being doomed to never be believed by anyone.
And the really tricky part, as they discussed, is how do you tell the difference between a righteous Cassandra and just the crazy person who's convinced by bad data?
It's a huge problem. And they gave some really powerful historical examples of people who were Cassandras, who spoke the truth early and paid a terrible price for it.
Like Rachel Carson.
Rachel Carson, yeah. In 1962, she writes Silent Spring, warning about the pesticide DDT. She was viciously attacked by the chemical industry, mocked by mainstream scientists, called a hysteric.
And decades later,
she was proven completely right. Her work led directly to the ban on DDT. But she had to endure years of character assassination first.
The other one they brought up was even more tragic. Ignaz Semmelweis.
Oh, that story is just heartbreaking. He's a doctor in the 1840s, and he figures out that if doctors just wash their hands after doing autopsies and before delivering babies, mothers stop dying of childbed fever.
A simple, revolutionary idea.
He proved it with data. He cut mortality rates dramatically. But the entire medical establishment rejected him. They couldn't accept the idea of invisible particles causing disease because germ theory didn't exist yet.
So what happened to him?
He was mocked, fired, and eventually died in a mental asylum. He was right, but he was decades too early, and it cost him his sanity and his life.
These are such powerful examples of the price of being ahead of the curve. But the best intellectual exercise they did was comparing Copernicus and Galileo.
Yeah, this was brilliant. It's the perfect illustration of the two paths you can take with a dangerous idea.
So Copernicus is first in the 1500s.
Right. He figures out that the Earth orbits the sun. He has the math. But he knows the church will destroy him for it. So what does he do?
He waits.
He waits until he is literally on his deathbed to publish his work. He chose safety. He prioritized his own survival over the immediate advancement of the idea.
And then 100 years later, you get Galileo.
And Galileo has even better proof. He has a telescope. He can see the moons of Jupiter. He knows it's true. And he doesn't wait.
He proclaims it.
He shouts it from the rooftops. And he pays the price. The Inquisition forces him to recant under threat of torture, and he spends the rest of his life under house arrest, silenced.
So what's the big takeaway from that? What's the danger in punishing the Galileo?
The lesson is profound. When you punish a Galileo, You teach the next generation of brilliant minds to be a Copernicus.
You teach them to shut up.
To self-censor, to delay progress, to protect themselves. You slow down the entire engine of human discovery because you make the cost of being honest and early way too high.
And in our world, social media is the new Inquisition, in a way. It's the tool for enforcing that silence through groupthink.
It's an incredibly powerful tool for it. For the first time, your adherence to the group's opinion is quantified in real time with likes and upvotes.
And the punishment for dissent is immediate and brutal.
Right. So they made the argument that what we call the culture war isn't really millions of people thinking for themselves. It's two armies of puppets, basically, being ventriloquized by a handful of actual thinkers who set the terms of the debate.
And most people just fall in line because it's psychologically painful to stand alone against the crowd.
It takes a very specific, very rare personality type to be willing to do that, and the digital world makes it harder than ever.
Which brings us directly to the modern day enforcement of that silence. This is where they shifted into talking about freedom, control, and the identity wars.
And they really focused on the legal landscape, drawing the stark contrast between the US and the UK.
Yeah, they were pretty alarmed by the UK's online safety bill.
Alarmed is an understatement. They cited this statistic that in a recent period, 12,000 people were arrested in the UK for things they posted on social media.
12,000.
They claimed that's more than in a country like Russia, which we think of as being so oppressive. Whether that specific comparison is accurate or not, the sheer number is staggering.
The chilling effect of that must be immense. It forces you to self-censor, not because you're saying anything illegal,
yeah,
but because you're afraid of how it might be interpreted.
And they linked this directly to the UK's history of, you know, persecuting its greatest minds. They brought up Alan Turing.
The man who cracked the Enigma code, saved millions of lives.
And was then chemically castrated by the British government for being gay. They only apologized decades after he was dead. It's this pattern of enforcing the proper behavior of the time.
Which history almost always proves to be wrong and barbaric later on.
And the core political warning they issued was universal. When you give a government the power to suppress speech, you're not just stopping bad ideas, you're stopping people from protesting horrible things.
Because power is never given back. It's always ramped up, usually under the guise of safety.
And this led them to this really slippery and dangerous modern concept of malinformation.
Okay, break that down. What is malinformation?
So it's not disinformation, which is a lie. And it's not misinformation, which is an honest mistake. Malinformation is defined as factual information that might cause harm.
Truth that is deemed dangerous.
Precisely. And the example they used to illustrate the danger was from the pandemic.
Right.
The statement, children do not need a COVID vaccine, is, for the most part, a factually and medically supported statement. But under a malinformation framework, a government could suppress that true statement.
Why?
Because they could argue it might cause harm by leading someone to not get vaccinated, who could then theoretically pass the virus to their grandmother. So the truth gets suppressed, not because it's false, but because it's inconvenient for the dominant narrative.
That's a terrifyingly broad power to give to anyone.
It's the ultimate control of the narrative. And from that abstract threat, they move to where this all becomes brutally physical and tangible.
Rubber meets the road.
Exactly. The issue of transgender athletes in sports.
This was a huge focus of the episode, and they used two really high stakes, explosive examples.
The first was the strong woman competition.
Okay, what happened there?
So the winner of the 2025 World's Strongest Woman competition was an athlete named Jamie Booker, who is 6'4" and weighs 400 pounds.
A huge person.
A giant. But after winning, she was stripped of the title because organizers found out she was biologically male and had lied on the entry forms.
And they just highlighted the sheer physical disparity, right?
I mean, a typical female competitor in that sport is maybe 5'8", 220 pounds.
Yeah.
The anatomical advantages of being a 400-pound biological male are just insurmountable. It's not a fair competition.
And the second example was even more complicated because it involved the highest levels of sport.
Right. The IOC, the International Olympic Committee, versus the International Boxing Association.
This is about a boxer named Khalif.
Yes. Khalif won a championship. The Boxing Association did a chromosome test, found an XY result biologically male, and disqualified her.
Seems straightforward.
But then the IOC, the Olympic Committee, stepped in, overruled them, calling the chromosome test arbitrary.
Wow. So the highest body in sports is rejecting objective biology in favor of self-identified gender, even in a combat sport.
That's the core of the conflict. And this led to the JRE host's main point, what they called the integrity argument.
Which is
simply that biological sex is real, and it has to be recognized in physical competition. If you ignore it, then women's sports as a category will just cease to exist.
Because you'd effectively just have one unisex category, which would be completely dominated by biological males. All the opportunities, the scholarships, everything created specifically for female athletes would just disappear.
And they introduce one last very provocative idea here, which was a concept of sandbagging.
Like in martial arts, where a black belt pretends to be a white belt to win a tournament easily.
Exactly. They acknowledge that, of course, most trans athletes are genuine, but they raise the uncomfortable question, what stops a bad actor, a psycho, from just pretending to be a woman in order to dominate women's spaces or, as they put it, to beat up women?
When the criteria are subjective, the system becomes vulnerable to people who want to abuse it for their own gain.
A very thorny issue.
Okay, let's pivot now. Because from all that external conflict, they turned inward to the personal psychological cost of ambition. This was the part on the price of greatness.
And they started with a very modern example. The potential boxing match between Jake Paul and Anthony Joshua.
The financial stakes are just insane.
Yeah.
A reported purse of $184 million.
So about $92 million each. But for Anthony Joshua, the 6'6", 252-pound former Olympic champion, the risk isn't just financial, it's existential for his career.
He's a legitimate top-tier heavyweight. He cannot afford to lose to Jake Paul. He can't even afford to look weak.
Because if he does, that massive, legacy-defining $200 million fight against Tyson Fury, it vanishes overnight.
So the incentives demand that he has to be absolutely vicious. It can't be like the Mike Tyson fight, which some people saw as just high-level sparring.
No, Joshua has to go in there and be a killer to protect his brand.
Hmm.
And that kind of high-stakes pressure connected perfectly to this deep dive on fulfillment they did using the words of the golfer, Scottie Scheffler.
Arguably the best golfer on the planet right now.
Yes.
And he's been so open about the reality of winning.
He talks about the hollow victory. He says that when he wins a major tournament, it feels awesome for about 2 minutes.
2 minutes.
It satisfies his need for accomplishment, he said. But it doesn't touch the deepest places of his heart.
That exposes the whole trap of ambition, doesn't it? You sacrifice your entire life for this one moment, and the moment itself is fleeting. And then the world just asks, okay, what's next?
Which is what led them to this big theme of madness and greatness.
The idea that many people sacrifice actual happiness, the thing they want, for success, the thing they think will get them happiness.
But it often doesn't. And their argument was that true world-changing greatness is almost always connected to some kind of productive madness, some demons, some trauma, some deep burning need to prove the world wrong.
Mike Tyson being the ultimate example.
A talent completely fueled by that internal fire. But they did offer some counterpoints, some examples of people who managed to find a balance.
The first was Ronnie O'Sullivan, the snooker player.
The Jew 8. His book is all about managing that internal chaos, that drive, dealing with these thoughts that he's worthless, even while everyone else sees him as a genius. He found an outlet in long-distance running.
A release valve for the pressure.
And the second, maybe the best example of a happy, successful person was Dave Chappelle.
And what was his secret?
He prioritized the craft, the art of comedy. He never got obsessed with the rankings or the money. He still shows up at small clubs, works on his sets, films everything. He's in love with the process, not the outcome.
That's a huge lesson. It contrasts with what they called the shame of simple pleasures.
Yeah, that feeling ambitious people get that if they enjoy the small, simple things in life, it means they're not aiming high enough. So they miss out on the entire journey waiting for a destination that, as Scheffler said, only feels good for 2 minutes.
The whole segment ended on a really sobering note, though, with the story of the singer Louis Capaldi.
A perfect example of not having the psychological constitution to handle success.
He has this immense talent, but the pressure of global fame made his Tourette's tic flare up so badly that it literally stopped him from being able to perform his own songs.
His success physically incapacitated him. It took away the one thing he was born to do. It's tragic, but the hosts did find a hopeful note in it.
The redemption arc.
The redemption arc. The public loves to watch someone climb to the top, lose it all, and then fight their way back. It reflects the human condition. It gives us hope. Like Churchill, who didn't really get into power until he was 65, it's never too late.
Okay, let's get to the final section, because just when you think they've covered everything, they went into some truly mind-bending cognitive science.
Yeah, the future of communication and the flaws in our own perception, they started with the terrifying reality of memory failure.
The idea that we remember things, but we remember them wrong. And the case they used was just astonishing. The psychologist, Donald Thompson.
It's an unbelievable story. A woman is assaulted in her home. While it's happening, the TV is on in the background and a show featuring the psychologist Donald Thompson is playing.
Okay.
Later, in a police lineup, she confidently identifies Thompson as her attacker.
But he has a perfect alibi.
A perfect alibi. He was on live television at the time. Her brain had literally taken the face she was seeing on the screen and superimposed it onto the memory of her attacker.
So her memory was vivid. She was 100% certain, but it was completely factually wrong.
And the surreal irony is that the TV show he was on, he was discussing the unreliability of eyewitness testimony.
You can't make that up. And this flawed, slow brain of ours contrasts so sharply with the actual speed of thought.
The brain thinks it's something like 4,000 words per minute.
The rate of fire of a machine gun.
But our output speaking, typing, it's incredibly slow by comparison. We're running supercomputer software on ancient hardware.
And they pointed out that even our best tools are often designed to be inefficient. The QWERTY keyboard.
It's a fossil. It was designed in the 1870s for old manual typewriters, and its entire purpose was to slow typists down so the mechanical keys wouldn't jam.
It's intentionally inefficient, and we're still stuck with it 150 years later.
Even though we have much better layouts, like the Dvorak keyboard. But we can't switch because of what they call the coordination problem. Everyone uses the inefficient system, so it's impossible for an individual to change.
But technology is obviously going to solve this communication bottleneck.
Which is where they brought up that alter ego device. This is where it gets really sci-fi.
Basically telepathy, right?
Close to it. It reads the tiny nerve signals your brain sends to your vocal cords before you speak. So you can have a conversation with someone else wearing one without saying a single word out loud. You think a question, and you hear the answer in your head through bone conduction.
A silent, high-speed conversation.
And here's the kicker. This kind of silent, mind-to-mind communication, it's exactly what people who report alien encounters describe. It suggests a terrifyingly efficient and maybe inevitable future for human interaction.
Wow. Okay, let's try to wrap this whole thing up. We've covered a massive amount of ground here.
We really have. From screen addiction and the flaws in climate activism to the biological reality of sports and the brutal psychological price of success.
And it seems like the central theme, the tension that runs through all of it, is this conflict between the surface level and the underlying reality.
I think that's it, exactly. It's the appearance of doing good versus actual progress. It's chasing rankings versus loving the craft. It's the performance of safety versus the real need for free expression.
It really forces you as a listener to look at where you're putting your own resources, your time and your attention. Are you investing in the difficult foundational things, or are you chasing the easy digital validation that leads to that hollow victory?
A question we all have to ask.
So here's the final thought we want to leave you with based on all this material. If the digital world we live in is largely designed to overwhelm your instincts and hijack your attention, what is one small thing you will consciously do differently this week to protect your time, that single most valuable, non-renewable resource, and convert it into a real long-term skill?
Definitely something to mull over. And if you want to hear it all for yourself, please check out Chris Williamson's fantastic work on the Modern Wisdom podcast.
And we will catch you on the next podcast commentary.